Thank you for joining me. We're here in hour two. Boy, hour one went by quickly. This is an interesting conversation. Kenny Johnson is with us, and he has been a successful writer, producer, director of film and television for more than four decades. And he's been, I know, you know, off air, we were talking real quickly. You were invited to be a producer on the Mike Douglas Show. Tell me about that first episode. Who was the guests on the first episode? Yeah.
Well, Westinghouse, I had had success as a producer director in New York, and Westinghouse asked me to meet the young guy that was becoming the new executive producer on the Douglas Show, who had seen my work and liked it, and invited me to join him. His name was Roger Ailes, a name you have heard lately in the news, who was really brilliant and fun and grand and very seductive. He talked me into. I said, Roger, I don't want to do 90 minutes live six times a week. I want to go to Hollywood and make films. You know?
Right.
And he said, well, I'll let you do a lot of film work if you come down, as long as we get our 90 minutes live every day, you know. And the great thing about the Douglas Show was that everybody in the world came through there, because we were the first and only daytime 90-minute show at that
right.
time. And we had an audience of like 40, 50, 60 million people a week. But as luck would have it, the very first people that I had thrown at me to interview on the show were Barney and Betty Hill, who were the couple that were at the time quite famous for having been the ones that had been abducted by aliens
right.
and anally probed. And they were so convinced that it happened, it was very hard not to believe them. It was a very peculiar thing to meet those people. And then, you know, later on, they did a TV movie of it. I think James Earl Jones played the guy. It was a mixed-race couple, which
right.
was also interesting in 1966 when we did it. I want to say Ellen Burstyn or somebody was like that was his wife. And it told their story and about how they had died peculiarly also.
Mm-hmm.
Their lives came to a strange end. But I always, when I realized I was coming on Coast to Coast, I thought, oh, wow, okay, aliens and stuff like that. And, I mean, you know, I've had many people write to me and say, now, do you really believe that there is a reptilian race like the visitors? And my feeling is has always been, no, but there could have been. Because that's one of the things I've always tried to do, Dave, is I had the good fortune of working with George Burns one time, the great American humorist. And George could tell you a story and just absolutely drag you in. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you'd say, and I said, George, what's the secret? And he said, "You got when you're telling a lie, Kenny, you got to put as much truth in it as you can, you know, and you just lead him down, and then you get him, you know." And I stuck with that, and that's what made The Incredible Hulk successful, as well as a lot of the other shows that I've done. And the aliens in V came about because we very easily could have been a reptilian race if the comet hadn't hit the planet in 65 million years ago and the dinosaurs hadn't gotten wiped out. We could have very easily adapted and become a reptilian race. So there was logic in it.
What was it like to be behind so many of these iconic TV shows? We'll find out when we return. Kenneth Johnson, my guest, as we continue on Coast to Coast AM. How do you take on some of the most iconic characters in the world and make them your own? Our guest tonight has firsthand knowledge. Kenny Johnson is here with us. We've been talking on and off, on air here and off air about some of these shows. One of my favorites. I grew up on The Courtships of Eddie's Father, so I wanted Bill Bixby to be my dad. Not that I had anything against my dad, but I just wanted a cool hipster dad that, you know, never hit.
Right.
So I was all about that. And then along comes The Incredible Hulk, which I thought it was funny. I asked you off air, and I'll bring it up real quickly. Okay. I needed to know this because my buddies and I still have a bet about this growing up. When the name was changed from the iconic Bruce Banner to David Banner, as David Schrader, I was very happy that the superhero had my name. But the whole deal was, I remember everybody talking about, well, they had to change the name because Bruce just sounded way too gay for a lead character.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
And you're aware of that weird urban legend, right?
I have heard of that, you know, and it always makes me chuckle. And it's sort of sad and peculiar, too. But the reason I was trying, what I was trying to do when I created the Hulk, because they gave me the opportunity to do, let me see, what did they say? We have five of the Marvel comic superheroes, Captain America was one of them. The Man from Atlantis was one. The Human Torch was one. Mary Marvel was one, or I think it was Ms. Marvel.
Right.
I remember
Mary Marvel
was Mary.
DC, right.
Right, yeah. And this thing, ludicrous thing called The Incredible Hulk. And I didn't want to do any of them, you know? I mean, I do a $6 million man bionic woman already. I'm becoming into the sci-fi pigeonhole, you know? And but Susie, my wife, had given me, who's the most literate person I've ever known, except our daughter, Katie, had given me a copy of Les Miserables to read. And I was in the middle of reading it, so I had Jean Valjean and The Fugitive and the concept in my head. And I thought, oh, well, let me see. There's a way to take a little Victor Hugo and a little bit of Robert Louis Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde and this ridiculous thing called The Incredible Hulk and make it an adult drama. And I said, I went to Frank Price, who was head of Universal and had been courting me about this. And I said, okay, look, I'll do it, but it's got to be done my way and it's got to be my casting. I don't want to have some actor shoved down my throat that you guys want. So they said, all right. And I wrote the pilot for The Incredible Hulk in 7 days. The whole two-hour movie in 7 days script, and we shot the white pages of my first draft. But when they sent the agent sent the draft to the only actor that I wanted to go to was Bill Bixby, and I'm told that when Bill was handed the script, Bill said, "I don't even want to read anything that's called the Hulk," right. And his agent said, "Yes, you do." And Bill read it, and we had met each other just casually a couple times earlier, but I had seen him in a television play in 1973 called Steam Bath. You mm-hmm. can get it on Netflix. It was a TV drama about people that are in a steam bath, Valerie Perrine, Bill Bixby, and several other people, and they slowly realize there's no way out. And that what they really are in is purgatory. And the little Puerto Rican steam bath attendant who is just sort of knocking around is really God. And it's Bill did a performance that was just to die for, and it stuck with me so strongly for 4 years that when I was casting, when I said, "Who do I want?" I said, "I want Bill," you know. And he read the script and came in and said, "Are we really going to do it? Is it going to be like this? Do I get to suffer? Is it going to be a drama, a psychological drama?" I said, "Yes, that's what I want to do," and that's what we set out to do. And you know, we were very lucky and had a good run.
It's something when you're watching what is essentially a corny superhero movie and or a TV series, and to have had the empathy and ethos that you brought. I remember crying at the end of episodes.
Yeah,
and I wasn't an overly sensitive kid, but we all had that connection with kind of feeling like the loner at times. And sometimes just not fitting in. And no matter how good things start to get, you've kind of got the reality of life again. And then is there any more iconic scene in any TV program than the bag slung over the shoulder and the thumb going out?
That's right. And Joe Harnell's brilliant piece of music that became iconic in its own right.
Right.
No, and that's exactly what I was striving for was. And that's, as I said, echoes of that have come into the novel in the Man of Legends, too, because here's a guy that is cursed essentially the same kind of way. It's the classic Greek tragedy where right. the hero brings down upon himself. The hero tampers with things better left to God, and the gods don't like that.
And it's a reluctant hero.
That's right. Oh, absolutely.
Which makes it even better. If you've got a guy out there, that's why I always found characters like Superman and Captain America so bland.
Mm-hmm.
Because what else could they do? And in this case, he had to temper it because even in his hero form, he was a violent force of nature.
It was very bad. I think part of the reason it connected with so many people, and the largest audience was adult women.
Yes,
the largest audience for all of my shows has been adult women and then adult men and then teens and then kids in that order. It's like the perfect demographics. And I think, Dave, it's because I've always been more interested in relationships and the emotional structure
right.
and the characterizations of people than I have in blowing things up and spaceships and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, V was never about reptilians and big spaceships and everything. V was about power. And about how you react, how different people react when suddenly this hyperpower rolls into their life and changes their life forever. And how do they react to it? Well, some people will suck up to it, like the Vichy French did in World War II, was sucking up to the Nazis and aggrandize themselves and to benefit themselves. The middle of the road people will say they'll be the go along to get along people, and I'll keep my head down and they won't bother me. And then other people will say, no, this power is being abused and we have to fight back. And that's what V was really about, was it was Spartacus and the revolt of the slaves. It was the American Revolution. It was apartheid. It was all of that when an oppressed people, you know, are determined to fight back against a hyperpower. And the exciting thing for me now is that I discovered a couple of years ago that I own the motion picture rights to V. And we are setting out to try to do it, set it up as a really big movie. All of the major studios came after it. And, you know, when something like that happens, you get a lot of new best friends in Hollywood, you know. And they all came after me and offered.
So was this something you created or was this something you adapted from the story that existed?
V came out of my pea brain.
That was yours.
Yeah, exactly. And
bravo, sir. That was truly one of the best sci-fi movies and miniseries I've ever seen.
Well, I appreciate it. And it, you know what? It is the highest rated work of science fiction in the history of television. And
really? It even beat The Day After?
Yes. The Day After was really more of a docudrama.
It right. Really, but it had that sci-fi kind of creep factor of what's it like after the Holocaust.
Or yeah, not but Holocaust, again it was more of a what have you. Then you'd have to say, well, Dr. Strangelove was science fiction too, or so was Failsafe science fiction. But
right.
I got you.
See what right.
I mean?
Right.
but V was clearly, you know, sort of purely science fiction. And so the game plan is to do V the movie first. And then I wrote a novel a few years ago called V the Second Generation, which picks the story up 20 years later. So we have enough to do really a sci-fi trilogy. And we're endeavoring. I decided not to do it with the studios because I was concerned about getting edged out of the creative control. And
not, you know, in Hollywood.
No. Could that happen?
No.
But speaking of creative control, I have a funny Stan Lee story just quickly to share with you.
For sure.
The second 2-hour movie that we did.
Of The Incredible Hulk?
Of The Incredible Hulk, yeah.
Okay.
I wrote a scene where the Hulk had to fight with a bear, because I was always looking for worthy adversaries.
Sure.
You know? And I wrote a scene, really good, and I was sending the scripts to Stan just out of courtesy. He wasn't really that involved with the show, but I wanted him to see what was going on. And he called me and he said, God, I love it. It's a scene with a bear is great. A robot, it's a bear is great. The fight is great. But you know, Kenny, it really, really ought to be a robot bear. And I said, no, Stan, let me explain why, okay? An audience, particularly an adult audience, will only buy so much, okay? They'll only give you so many buys.
Right.
And now, Stan, step back and think about this. We're asking the American people and the worldwide people to buy that Bill Bixby metamorphoses into Lou Ferrigno. I said, that's a really big buy, Stan.
And not just Lou Ferrigno, but a green Lou Ferrigno.
That's right. And he's green, which I said, Stan, why isn't he red? And I said, the color of rage is red, but they wouldn't let me change the color. Got to change his name, but not the color. And I said, Stan, when you add a robot bear on top of that initial buy, you're out of the park and it doesn't make sense anymore. And it's no longer an adult show. And Stan and I went around and around about it for a week or more. He was on the East Coast and I was on the West. But finally he called me up and said, you know what? You're right. And he said, you got what you're saying is exactly right. I get it. And since then, he has so often said, bless his heart, that he wished I had done all of his shows because he really felt that the Hulk had actually sort of kickstarted, you know, a lot of other things, too. It was very rewarding to have somebody that I admire and as much as Stan to come around to that feeling.
Now, it's important, as much as I love and respect Bill Bixby and the work that he did. Yeah, it's important for a lot of people to know because the end of the series itself, people just remember as the few 2-hour movies, the Return of the Incredible Hulk, the something of the Incredible Hulk, and the Death of the Incredible Hulk. And they introduced Thor, and they introduced Matt Murdock, the Daredevil.
Right.
But you had nothing to do with those 2-hour reunion movies.
No,
okay.
I stepped. I was not involved with any of those, and I have never even seen them, as a matter of fact, because my friends who worked on them said, you don't want to,
no.
Kenny. They were not what we did. It was not the quality. Because, you see, the theme that was running through all of the Hulk was the enemy within. That's
right.
What Bixby was struggling with. And I tried to use that kind of theme all the way through because so many of us have different kinds of enemies within. With Dr. Banner, it was anger. But with other people, it's drugs, it's drink, it's alcohol, it's obsession, it's mm-hmm. greed, it's whatever. And we would do the shows that were thematically, so that we could really have some substance underneath. And I think that's probably what's made why I've been so lucky to have created the things that really have become kind of iconic, Dave, and stuck, because I never got into this business to try to get rich or be famous or anything like that. I just wanted to be a good storyteller, you know? And it was so important to me to tell stories that were important. So what I've tried to do is take a high concept situation and then fill it with substance underneath, so that when people, I get so many letters from people about V, for example, where they say, you know, when I was 12 or 13 years old, I loved all the spaceships and the stuff. Now I'm 30 and 35 or so and looking at it again and realizing, oh, there was a lot more going on here than I realized. It was all the echoes of the French Resistance, of the echoes of Nazism, the echoes of the Holocaust, and all of that. And it's great when you can take really deep, meaningful stuff like that and put it into a commercial shell that people will tune in to see, and then you can hopefully maybe make something that's a little thought provoking.
We've got so many things to cover and so little time, and I've got some people calling in. Let's dig a quick call. Wildcard Line 1, Wayne from Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, thank you. Great show.
Thank you. Thank you for listening in this evening. What's your question for Kenny Johnson?
Yes, I'd like to ask your guest, around what year was it when you saw that special film about the Holocaust that they brought in for you?
Well, let's see. I was in seventh grade. It was, and so I was about 13. I would have been about 1954, maybe.
Oh, 1954.
54.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm an old guy.
Okay, right.
Thank you.
I was about seventh grade, but it was like 1974. So
big right. difference.
Right.
I saw those same films that you were talking about.
Right.
First. So I was just wondering what the difference was with years between us.
Well, I think back then, first of all, so many people hadn't seen anything like that, and I certainly had never seen anything like that, and or even imagined that there could have been anything like that, and it was just a really life-changing experience, as I'm sure it was, you know, for anybody that saw it later on.
You worked in these amazing shows long before the advent of current special effects. And,
yes.
You know, I've seen the first two Incredible Hulk movies that the big budgets put out, and they don't hold a candle to the storylines that you guys were able to bring in 1970s and early 80s TV. I mean, you did an amazing job with a limited budget and a limited capability for special effects. What was that like for you to explore and make somebody painted green have... that you care about and sell that part of the story?
Well, it was really frustratingly difficult.
Sure.
because we went around and around about saying, okay, how are we going to see this metamorphosis happen? You know, I got inflatable wetsuits to see if we could blow things, you know.
Oh, sure.
And ultimately we realized, no, the best thing to do was just to put really tight shirts on Lou Ferrigno, who would be all scrunched down, and weaken the seams in some of them so that we could pull a thread out and he could just puff up a little bit and pop the buttons and that sort of thing. But the makeup stuff, I mean, when we did the first transformation, when Bix first metamorphoses into Lou, we had to do it the same way they did the Wolfman in 1940s. You know, we had to put him in front of the camera, put a little makeup on, roll a little film, stop the camera, put a little more makeup
on. So very stop motion.
That's right.
Right.
And then do a dissolve from, you know, stage to stage to stage. And now, of course, you can do Voldemort and take people's noses off and, you know,
right.
and all of that sort of stuff. And it was very frustrating because we did not have the tools. I ran into the same problem when we were doing V originally, and we were at the production meeting and reading through the script, and we got to the scene where I had written, Diana picks up the live guinea pig and
yes.
opens her mouth, and her jaw distends much larger than a human's, and she puts the guinea pig in, and we see it go down her throat and bulge out. And I remember at the production meeting, there was this pause and a little laughter from all of my team, and Tom Reba, my special effects guru, said, Kenny, how are we going to do that? And I said, beats the hell out of me, Tommy. Better get with Werner Kepler, our makeup guy, and see what you can figure out. And they figured out.
That stands out to me. That moment.
it was a seminal moment.
When you see the masks come off, and
yeah.
then that minute when she unhinges the jaw and swallows,
right. it's,
that guinea pig stuck with me. I don't think there was a boy my age that didn't try to look at their pet guinea pig or rabbit and think, how
did that happen?
Right.
No, so we had to build a Werner Kepler, a makeup guru, Emmy Award winner, Academy Award winner, built a whole false head for Jane Badler where we could really open the mouth that wide. And we used Jane's arm to push the guinea pig in. No guinea pigs were harmed in the making of this film, although the outtakes are pretty hysterical because it took about half an hour to get a guinea pig to go down the right way. And then we had a prosthetic on her neck. pack that was an air bladder where I could literally blow up three different little bladders to make it look like it was going down with the peristalsis kind of effect. But it's a lot easier to do nowadays than it would have been then, that's for sure. And there's some effects in V where we spent maybe $60,000, $70,000 for 20 seconds of film that you can do on your cell phone today, and they would look better.
Unbelievable stuff. Kenny Johnson is with us. When we come back, let's talk about the Bionic Woman and the $6 million man. Plus, we've got so many other stories to cover. And I blame you, Kenny, for making alien women sexy to me with Alien Nation. Now I'm prepared that if we are ever taken over, I'm willing to mate with alien races. So thank you for that. We've got so much more to cover on the show. Stay with us. This is Coast to Coast AM. This is the best in overnight talk radio. 7 nights a week, you can join George Norrie. And if you've missed any of these shows and you'd like to catch up, it's real simple to do. Just go to coasttocoastam.com and become a Coast Insider. You subscribe right now for a year subscription, breaks down to no more than about 15 cents a day, and you'll get the best in overnight talk radio, plus 5 years of past episodes. You'll be able to tune in and hear some of your favorite guests over and over. And if you've missed episodes, you can always catch up. I've been with the show now 4 years, so you can catch up with all of the episodes, plus the episodes I've been a guest on. So go check that out. Become a Coast Insider. You'll find out why we are the best in overnight talk radio. Plus, you get exclusives and perks like live chats with some of the guests and the hosts of Coast to Coast AM. And listen, summer is finally here. Right? If you're bored of sitting at home alone watching Netflix and wish you had somebody to share your life with, and you want to start catching up on all the reruns of The Incredible Hulk and The $6 Million Man and The Bionic Woman, but you're tired of doing it alone, well, we've got the audience for you. Did you know you can sign up at ParanormalDate.com and you could meet the love of your life, another fellow nerd to share in all the joy as you hold hands across the couch watching all of these amazing shows we're talking about tonight? You're listening to the show. That means they are too. Why not get a chance to meet your new best friend or the love of your life? ParanormalDate.com. George Norrie put it together knowing you were looking for the person that would complete your life, and it's just as easy as signing up right now. They've got over 50 gajillion members already. Why not meet those people now? And again, whether it's just your new best friend, somebody to share a laugh, a love, or enjoy the great shows that have been produced over the last 40 years together, check it out, ParanormalDate.com. All right, it's time to play a little flashback for you here. How many of you remember these iconic sounds? Yeah, that's a good one. The Sounds of Silence. Oh, there we are. My eyes are focusing as we are listening to this one.
That's it. That's the bionic eye.
The bionic man's eye. The $6 million man's eye. Do we have some of the running or the bending of... Yeah, there we go. The jumping sounds. This was amazing to me. Our guest Kenny Johnson is with us. He's the author of a brand new novel, and if you love the shows we're talking about, you got to check out the new book, The Man of Legends. And it's coming out, you said, July 1st, correct?
Yes, it'll be out July 1st in print and audiobook and digital and Kindle.
Yeah, and the audiobook, they've got all of these celebrities doing the voices and the stories. You've got to check it out. You could have done it all by yourself, Kenny. You were rocking out the voices through this whole thing.
I was very lucky. I was trained by Edith Skinner, who had been trained by the real Henry Higgins.
Oh.
And Edith taught us about 60 or 70 different dialects, and I've been blessed with a little bit of a good ear sometimes, so I can occasionally I can drop into something.
That is very cool.
I'm a Russian submarine commander.
We've got a lot to talk about tonight on the show. You just heard some of those special effects sounds. And you know what? In hindsight, you watch the Bionic Man and or the $6 million Man and the Bionic Woman, and they run fast. Only they're running slow.
I know.
You convey such a great deal by doing that and giving the chance to just see the motion of the body as they're straining against all the odds. And that great sound effect that... As a kid, I just bought it. As a matter of fact, do you know how many miles I ran in my backyard going...
Oh, yes, it's true. I hear this. I hear a lot of people talk about that, about how they would run in the playground in slow motion, and all of that. And people ask me also, if she's got such a great bionic ear, why does she always have to brush that little bit of hair out of the way of her ear? You know, when she's... Well, we just did that to bring attention right, to the ear, of course.
Just like the arched eyebrow of, right. of Major Steve Austin as he'd start to
That's
focus
right.
in with that bionic
That's
eye.
Right. I said, Oscar, I can't go in there, you know. Lee always talked a little bit like he was constipated, Dave, you know. But he was great. He was always, what a pro. He was there all the time and on the money, knew his lines and bingo, and it was great. The reason we hired Lindsay, I was introduced to Harve Bennett, who was producing Rich Man, Poor Man and a lot of the big miniseries in those days.
Oh, he went on to do work with Star Trek.
Oh,
as well,
yeah,
he did.
He did a couple of the several of the Star Trek movies later on. But I was introduced to him by Stephen Bochco, who had been a classmate of mine at Carnegie. And Steve had gotten his foot in the door first at Universal and sort of helped me to get my foot in the door and introduced me to Steve Cannell. And we were all sort of the class of 1980 at Universal, you know. And but Harve had done the $6 million, was doing the $6 million Man, they were already on the air, and all the slow motion stuff had already been determined. Okay, this is how we're going to do it. And I said, why? And he said, because this is how we do it. And
because of the fake running fast, like that horrible
stupid
scene in Superman.
That's right. It can't do it. At least we couldn't in TV with the effects that we had in those days. But you know. He asked me, he had read a spec script that I wrote in and asked me for some ideas. And I said, well, how about the Bride of Frankenstein? I mean, you've got this monster man. Shouldn't there be a female companion, a bionic woman? And that's where she came from. And one of the funny parts about it is that, funny now, is that at the end of the two-parter, they wanted her to die. And I said, well, that's a mistake. Let me just leave her in a deep freeze, you know. And that's the way I wrote the script. She was in cryogenic somewhere off. You know? And they said, no. We want to do love story. We want her to be really dead so our hero gets to mourn and sad. And we don't want a lot of bionic people running around, right? And so that's what I did. Okay, cerebral hemorrhage. She was gone, right? And then the letters started coming in. My favorite came from the head of the Boston University psychology department, who said, how dare you create such a great female archetype and then toss her away, you know, like that. And the studio was looking at that, but they were also looking at the ratings for Six Mill, which suddenly went way up. And they came to me and said, yeah, Kenny, why'd you kill her off anyway? That was a dumb idea. You know, bring her back to life.
Come on, Kenny.
We want to bring her back. Okay, so I had it retooled and we did, and Lindsay was the exact right actress because she was pretty but not Hollywood beautiful. We really wanted a Girl Next Door kind of feel. But the thing that was really magical about Lindsay was that she made you absolutely convinced that she was making it up as she went along.
Right.
She never sounded like she was reading words or doing lines or a script. There was just enough fumfering and enough clumsiness that was so artistically done that you just completely were drawn in by her. And she was just a sensational actress and did so much to, it was because of her, I think the show was as successful as it was.
We'll filter in a few more of your calls. We have to take a break. I'm Dave Schrader, your host this evening, along with me, my guest, Kenny Johnson, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back. This is Coast to Coast AM, sitting in for George Norrie. I'm Dave Schrader. I'm having the time of my life tonight. I'll be back with you guys tomorrow night when we talk about the untimely death of Kurt Cobain, soaked in bleach. Is there more to the alleged suicide of grunge rocker Kurt Cobain? There's so much of this story that you may not know, and we're going to talk with an investigator who was hired by Courtney Love to try to locate and find Kurt Cobain when he went missing. We're going to talk to the producer, I believe from the East Coast. He's going to be calling in regarding the documentary Soaked in Bleach. They'll be with us all 4 hours tomorrow night. We'll take your phone calls. We'd love to hear from you and be a part of that show as well. Because time is flying so much, folks, and I'm not giving our callers their due, Kenny has agreed to stand for an extra half an hour with us tonight so we can try to get through as many of your calls as we can in the next few segments. But a few questions. We were just talking about Lindsay Wagner and working with the Bionic Woman and that kick. Something that was really fascinating to me about that was that, if I recall, is one of the first series that leapt over two different
crossovers.
Right. So you've got him on two separate networks, and you've got the character actor who played Oscar Goldman able to jump between these two, and then you'd bring these two characters into each other's worlds. That must have been really a work of art to have that ability back.
Well, it was the first time that anybody had done it, and they didn't jump networks. When we were doing the crossovers, we were still on ABC, because Bionic 6 Mil was on ABC, and then Bionic came on to there too, and then eventually Bionic Woman went over to NBC for the last part of the season, but I was really leaving the show by then. But yeah, the idea of doing crossovers was obvious, and it was a great way to cross promote the two shows, because 6 Mil was very, very popular for a while. And well, what happened too was once I brought the Bionic Woman back to life, and she was such a it had taken the $6 million man into the top 10 for the first time. And to give you an idea of what an achievement that was, we were on Sunday nights opposite All in the Family when it was the number one show in the country.
Right.
And we were also in the top three or four on 6 Mil. And when the Bionic Woman had, suddenly, obviously, ABC sees a gold mine, and they said, look, not only do we want her to come back for a return of the Bionic Woman, but we want to spin her off into her own show. And for a while, I was writing and producing both shows at the same time, Dave, which is doing one episodic television show is like living in a garbage disposal. But doing two was like, eventually I left 6 Mil and just stayed with Bionic so that I could direct more. And because you don't have time to breathe when you're trying to do two shows, but there was a while where I had the number one and number three shows in the country simultaneously, and it was
Now the interesting thing too about the Bionic Woman, you had a rise in fandom from a part of the world that just at first you wouldn't think there would be this connection. Right.
I think what you're talking about is the fact that I mentioned that I've gotten a lot of letters from the LGBTQ community.
Right.
About how they so identified with Jamie, particularly, and because she was different on the inside than she was on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I was absolutely fascinated to realize that. Certainly, it was nothing I was thinking of while we were doing the show, or might have thought of at all. But it's so true, because we always tried to play into that constantly when we were doing the show, to mine all of the humanistic aspects of Jamie, the female and the human aspects. The fact that writers would come in and say, "Okay, Jamie's going to come into this scene and she's going to turn over a truck," and I go, "No, she can't turn over a truck." So, but she's bionic. I said, yeah, she's bionic. She can turn over a car, but not a truck. You know, she can jump
she
up.
She had limits.
She can jump up two stories, but she can't jump up three. She can jump down three, but she can't jump down four, or she'll break. You know,
right.
There were limits. Because one of the things about doing anything where you're taking a step beyond reality is to decide what the rules are and then stay inside of those rules. And that's like when Stan Lee asked me to do a robot bear. And I said, "No, Stan, it doesn't work. It takes you." He said, "But on the Bionic shows, you do robotic kind of things." And I said, "Yeah, but there we're in the robotic universe, and we're not having to strain credulity too much. With the Incredible Hulk, I'm trying to make him live as much as I can in the real world. I mean, I even took him to New York and run him through Times Square for one of the episodes. I wanted to see if anybody in Times Square would notice the green guy was running down.
Not when you have the naked cowboy.
Well, I tell you, a lot of people did notice. It was also very funny because Louis Ferrigno used to say to me, "Kenny, why doesn't the Incredible Hulk have more dialogue?" And I said, "Well, Louis, for starters, he's not from Brooklyn, And when we were there to do the Louis running through Times Square, we had his trailer set up just off of Broadway, and his whole family came over from Brooklyn. And you walk into his trailer, and it was like, "Hey, Vinny, hey, Saul, hey, Louis, hey, Louis, Aunt Maria, how you doing?" And the whole family was Brooklyn, and it was really funny.
Very cool. Exciting stories. This is so fascinating to hear about the background on these different tales. I'm curious, in working with this, you left Bionic Woman, though, after the second season. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. It
was it creative differences or just burning out on that sci-fi genre?
It was a little of both, I think.
Okay.
It's interesting. Lindsay had been a contract player at Universal,
mm-hmm.
and after we did the Bionic Woman, the Universal let her contract lapse, and suddenly when ABC wanted to bring back the Bionic Woman, her agent had them over a barrel, and they had to come up with a whole lot of money in order to get her to come back in. Which, you know, good for her. She lucked out. Lee Majors was not happy about it, though, because he had spent a long time working his way up from through Big Valley and other shows like that to where he was getting paid pretty well at that point. And all of a sudden, here's this newcomer.
She gets a start on his show, and she's making
his
money.
Yes, and she's making his money,
right?
Close to it. And it was a little testy, you know. And, I mean, they worked together okay, and we did the shows. And we did those crossover shows that you talked about where one would be on one show, and then we'd carry the story over to another one. And sometimes carry it back to the first show, and you know, and it was fun to do that. But Lindsay was having a hard time right then. She was in a difficult relationship with a husband whom she didn't last very long with, and it was probably better off for her. But I just felt that this was a train that was headed for a cliff. And
gotcha. And time to get out of there before
right.
it hit.
And I had already done the pilot for The Incredible Hulk, and Universal asked me to stay on for the transition to NBC, which I did for that long. But then finally we said, no, it's not a good place for me to be, and I'm just not comfortable there. And there was a lot of substance abuse going on that I didn't want to have any part in too. So I stepped away from it. And I'm pleased to say, though, that Lindsay and I were reunited. I guess it was about 10 years ago. There was a BionicCon down in Florida where they called me and said, "Would you? We're having a Bionic Woman convention, the first time she'd ever done one. Would you come?" And I said, "Sure, I'd be happy to." And when we saw each other, she just burst into tears and threw herself into my arms, and it was like no time had passed, and we were right at the beginning again. It was wonderful. And also, they had surprised me by bringing in Lou Ferrigno and Mark Singer from V. And suddenly I have this great photograph of me and my three stars that's like, wow, you know, did we really do that?
That's,
you know,
awesome.
It was great.
Andre the Giant.
Andre.
What is it like to have Bigfoot? And I mean, you're on the show to talk about this. Bigfoot fighting the $6 million. Those were some of the scariest episodes for me. And was just awesome to see this display in. What a swath this guy
well,
cut,
it
huh?
Was, yeah, it was really fun. You know, I wrote the character and then said, okay, how are we going to do this? And we went out looking for big guys, and somehow the casting director managed to rope Andre into it. He was a wrestler.
Right.
By then, 7.5 feet tall. I still have his foot cast in my office. I guess he was about 300 pounds or change. He was big guy, right? And he spoke nothing but French when we were working together. This was long before he did the Princess Bride,
right,
which is so brilliant. He was great. Lee was a little concerned about having to do fights and stuff with him. The trickiest part, though, was I had written a scene where in the script it said they'd had their fight or something, and Bigfoot had scooped up Lee, Steve Austin, and had to carry him. And I wrote, he carries him into this mysterious ice tunnel that is rotating. And my production manager called me and said, "What are you, crazy? This is a one-hour episodic television. We can't build rotating ice tunnels. Are you out of your mind?" Teddy Shell's a little guy. Talk like that, with a lot more colorful language. And I said, "Teddy, let me take you to the back lot and show you something that's on the Universal Tour."
Right.
And they had this thing, a rotating ice tunnel.
Sure.
And he said, "Oh, we can use this, and it's free." And I said, "Yeah, it's great." The only problem was, we discovered, Dave, was trying to film in it was a nightmare, because as soon as the thing started turning, we all fell over. And I'd say, "Okay, it's easy. We just open up the door at the end, so as soon as you can see the horizon, you're going to be okay." Wrong.
You
know? And at one point, Andre is supposed to carry Lee down through this ice tunnel, and Lee was saying, "Kenny, he's going to drop me on my butt, man. You know, I know he can't carry. He can't walk straight." And I said, "No, I've taught him the secret, Lee. All he has to do is look down. If you looked down and not at the walls and focused on the floor, you could do it." And so there's the scene in the show where Andre is carrying him, and he's just sort of keeping his eyes down so that he can get through it.
Why Sasquatch? What was the inspiration?
Oh, Bigfoot was big in those days.
Right.
You know, he was everywhere. And there was always, you know, the photos over here like the Loch Ness Monster and stuff. And so it was one of the first scripts that I wrote when I took on the $6 million man. But it took us a couple of months to find somebody that could do it. And then when we later did the return of Bigfoot, I think on Six Wheel and Bionic, it was one of the crossover shows. Andre was not available because he was making way more money wrestling than he would be making with us. And we got Ted Cassidy to come in, who was
Lurch.
Yes, who was like 7.5 feet tall also, very tall guy, voice from the center of the earth down here, you know. And Ted actually is the voice that you hear in the main title of The Incredible Hulk. It's Dr. David Banner.
That's the whole narration.
That's the whole narration is Ted. And also Ted did also all of the Hulk growls and roars and stuff for us for as long as he lived. And then we lost him in the middle of the show, and then Charlie Napier took over all the growling.
Right. Oh, wow. That is fascinating stuff. All right, folks. Our guest is kind enough. He's going to hang with us for another half an hour. I know phone lines are lit up. I didn't want to ignore you. We will get to your calls in the next half an hour. If you can make a concise question, we will try to burn through as many calls as we can when we return to the show. I'm Dave Schrader. I'm your host this evening. I'm the host of Darkness Radio, Beyond the Darkness, which can be heard on Podcast One 5 days a week, the best in paranormal talk radio. And I would love for you to check out our show. It's free. It's fun. You can find all the information about that and our new true crime show by visiting darknessradio.com. That's darknessradio.com. You can also shoot me emails, dave@darknessradio.com. We'll be back with more of the best in 70s and 80s sci-fi TV with Kenny Johnson on Coast to Coast AM.